machines, instruments, and other dusty old stuff that clutters up their home. He'll be speaking to us today on the collection of J.L. Walker's Native American Cylinder records, From Discovery to Recovery. So if you'll welcome with me, Lance Christensen.
Thank you very much. Can everyone hear me? All right, this is a slight deviation from the program you have in front of you. The actual abstract, the title says J.L. Walker, and that's just living proof that no matter how many times something goes through changes, you can still miss a typo. We're going to do right now, this concerns the electronic transfer of 23 surviving cylinder recordings that were made at the Pine Ridge Reservation sometime between 1905 and 1908. To begin with, this, of course, I need to answer a few simple questions. First of all, who am I? Where are these recordings housed? And why should we preserve them electrically? You've already heard a little bit about me, and that's pretty much straightforward. My involvement with this was purely personal. This is something that I wanted to do and something I thought needed to be done, and so I volunteered to do it. This is outside of the scope of my duties as an archivist at the Colorado State Archives, and pretty much a labor of love. These recordings are housed at the Colorado Historical Society, and as you'll hear a little bit later, that the path from Pine Ridge to Colorado was a bit of a convoluted one, but they not only house these recordings, but also the majority of Dr. Walker's written papers. The Society was founded in 1879, and their purpose is preserving the private records and donated records of the citizens of Colorado, located at 1300 Broadway in downtown Denver, about a block away from the state capitol. So why transfer these records electrically? Well, first of all, the availability of new technology, specifically technology that I could get my hands on to do it, which allowed me to access the records without doing any further wear to them, or at least minimal wear compared to previous efforts. Previous acoustical transfers really weren't all that good, and so it necessitated, especially for scholars, finding a better way to not only get a better recording off of these, but also to get more intelligibility. Once again, I mentioned the ability to do the transfers with minimal impact was a great consideration to the Historic Society, because they did not want to risk having the records have any further wear to them. And finally, a number of Native American scholars, including the curator at the Colorado Historical Society, Keith Shrum, had a renewed interest in these and were hoping to perhaps get some new insight from these recordings. And I mentioned my personal interest. Why not do it? So we'll start with a little bit of a discussion about Dr. Walker. Dr. Walker was born in near Richview, Illinois in 1849. He was one of 10 children. He enlisted in the Union Army at the age of 14 and then finished school after the war. A little bit different than they do things nowadays, obviously. He got his Doctor of Medicine from Northwestern University School of Medicine and began practicing medicine in 1874. He was married in 1877. He actually started as a physician at the Indian reservations, first at Leech Lake Indian Reservation in Minnesota, where he actually battled a smallpox epidemic that killed approximately 70% of the population that was residing there. That was where he first got an interest in actually learning more about how the natives actually treated disease and their viewpoint on doing that sort of thing. He moved to the Colville Indian Reservation in eastern Washington in 1893. From there to the U.S. Indian School in Carlisle, Pennsylvania, and then finally to the Pine Ridge Reservation in 1896, where he stayed until his retirement. He began a long association with Clark Whistler, who was at the American Museum in New York. And Whistler began helping him do the ethnographic studies. He began an ethnographic and anthropological studies of the Oglala Lakota, and began applying both traditional medicine, medicines that they used, along with the modern medicines he had. He became very close to the elders because they recognized in Dr. Walker that he not only had an interest in them, but he also respected their way of life and respected their teachings. And so they actually made him a holy man. He became one of the first white men to actually gain that position. And through that, he was able to gain insights into their myths and into their actual ritual beliefs. Here you see Dr. Walker and Clark Whistler. These are both later photographs. But they had a long correspondence between the two of them that lasted over 10 years, with Walker sending both writings and then later recordings to Clark Whistler. Chief among these recordings and one of the closest friends of Dr. Walker was this man. This is George Sword. His original name was Long Knife before he became a Christian, and he was one of the holy men of the Lakota. And what makes him interesting, not only does he show up in a lot of the writings that we have, but also he was instrumental in getting the recordings made. The recordings were made between 1905 and 1908. And originally, there were 36 records that were made of various songs and rituals. These were sent to the American Museum. The present whereabouts of those recordings is unknown, although a set of 23 of them recorded to tape is at Indiana University. Then there were 25 additional records, which is what you're going to hear today, that were made specifically of the Sun Dance. And part of the reason why the Lakota wanted this done is that the elders, at least by this period of time in 1906, the Sun Dance was banned on the Pine Ridge Reservation, part of the United States government's efforts to get the Lakota away from their native beliefs and make them more like white men. And so the elders saw the recordings as a way of speaking to their descendants and preserving their way of life, which was very important to them. Of the 25 original cylinders, 23 survive. They're all in commercial containers, and they have written on them descriptions of what's on them that's written in phonetic Lakota, which was a predecessor to the modern written Lakota language. Chief among the people that are associated with these recordings and probably are heard on these recordings are George Sword, Little Wound, of course the great chief Red Cloud, and Afraid of Bear, who was George Sword's older brother. After making the recordings and continuing his studies, Walker did leave the reservation. He retired in 1913. He moved to Fort Lupton, Colorado, which is just north of Denver. He published many texts on the Lakota and on the Sun Dance. The Sun Dance monographs particularly are considered to be very pivotal in the study of the Lakota because of his viewpoint that he had on it. He wasn't just an observer, he was actually involved in it, despite the fact he never actually saw the Sun Dance. But he had enough description given to him by the chiefs that it made it worthwhile. He later moved to Wheat Ridge, Colorado, which is a suburb of Denver, and then he died in 1926. His daughter donated his papers and the recordings to the Colorado Historical Society in 5 deposits, starting in 1958. The collection was cataloged and researched by Maurice Frink, who was the executive director of the Historic Society at that time, who actually developed a deep interest in the recordings and actually worked on a book that he never actually finished. His notes that he collected for that were donated to the society and actually comprise part of the collection that's there. This is what the cylinders look like. This is one of the better ones. As you'll notice, the cylinders are in excellent condition. There's no mold on them. They're just really, really amazing specimens. And you can see the handwritten notes on the cylinder. It's a paper label that's been glued into place. I particularly like this quote. This comes from Clark Whistler, and it's pretty straightforward. He had procured some phonographic records from the lips of an aged Blackfoot, and by way of making conversation, enlarged on the wonderful ability of the man who had invented this marvelous apparatus. The old man would have none of this. The inventor, according to him, was not a whit abler than anyone else, he contended. He merely had the good fortune of having the machine, with all of its details, revealed to him by a supernatural being. There's no record of what Mr. Edison would have thought of that. We don't actually know how the recordings were made. What we do know is that Whistler provided the machine and the records. Whether he provided instruction is unclear. When you hear the recordings, you'll notice the quality on them really is excellent. So one would assume that perhaps some instruction was provided, or perhaps he was just very lucky. We also don't know what sort of machine was used to record these. The blanks appear to be, for the most part, they appear to be Edison blanks based on the spiral grooves on the inside. Some of them might be commercial records that have been shaved, but there's no way of knowing whether it was on a Columbia machine or an Edison machine or some other type of machine. That's not documented. As I said before, of the 25 records, 23 of them survive. One of the records is broken, and two of the others have significant damage. The damage to them appears as if they were possibly overplayed, or it basically what it is the grooves have been rubbed out in significant portions of the record. So when you get to that part of the record, you really have no information on them. But otherwise, as I said, there's no mold on them, except for those two examples. They're actually in fabulous condition. 17 of the records have the written labels on them. At this time, we're not 100% sure if the records are in the correct boxes, and this is waiting for scholars who can actually understand the spoken Lakota to translate them. And what makes this interesting, too, these records were made at a time when the Lakota were going through a transition. The first written Lakota language was being developed, and the younger members of the tribe actually learned how to speak from looking at the written Lakota. That's the way they were taught in the schools. And that written Lakota was different. It was a simplified version of what the elders spoke. And it actually got to a point by the time these records were made that the language that the elders spoke, the young people couldn't understand them. And they actually had to have translators, middle-aged members of the tribe that would actually translate what the elders were saying to the young people, so they no longer spoke the same language. The first recovery efforts to be made with these that I've been able to locate were done in the 1960s. Maurice Frink actually recorded these. Listening to the records, it sounds like that he recorded them on some kind of instantaneous disc recorder. You hear the surface noise of a record that's aside from the surface noise that's on the cylinders. They're recorded acoustically, so he obviously set up a microphone near a machine. And the only preservation we have of these is a 5-inch magnetic tape that I think is not even an original tape. It's a copy of the materials, and some of the records are no longer on that. But here's an example of what he did at that time.
Some of these records started on the beveled edge, ran completely off the end. On the whole, they were put in a pretty good recording. That machine that they had in those days and the amateur type of recording. This is record number one of the Dr. Walker collection of Indian songs.
As you can hear, the quality is not great on that, but considering up to that point, the only way to play those records was to play them and actually hear them, that was probably a big step at that time. Second effort was made in 1986. The Historic Society arranged for transfers and actually sent the cylinders out of state to the University of Indiana, Bloomington. When you listen to these recordings, these were recorded on an open reel tape. Once again, it's an acoustic reproduction. You hear a microphone in front of the machine. You hear the machine being turned on. In some places, you actually hear the needle drop, and then they have to lift it up and start it again because it doesn't start at the exact beginning. So there's a significant noise on this. There's no logging on the tape whatsoever of which cylinders are in which order, so it's a pure guesswork whether they were done in order at all. And in fact, on the recordings where the damage was on the records, they, instead of playing through the damage, they just skipped that part and just played where there was actually stuff on there. So it's actually hard sometimes to tell even where one cylinder ends and one cylinder begins. This has been the primary access for these recordings for the last 20 years. And this is what that sounds like. This is the same record. It's a little bit better. One thing you will hear when you listen to some of these recordings, one of the problems they had with these early recordings is the use of drums on them. As anyone who's worked with acoustic recordings knows, drums tend to overpower everything, which is why a lot of studio recordings didn't use them at all. But of course, for the Lakota, they needed the drums as part of their ceremony. So acoustic playback just makes that a little bit more obvious. The drums are reproduced a little bit louder. And so that's an issue. Of course, I already mentioned the fact that one of the problems for researchers is the fact there's no documentation, verbal or written, to go along with the tape that was transferred by Indiana University. So there's no way to actually correlate that with what exists now. And then finally, it's one of the interesting things I've discovered about this collection, and perhaps some of you who have dealt with this sort of thing have seen this before, is that when you have an audio collection that's part of a written collection, sometimes the two are just considered separate. And what I found with this is there's a lot of written material that describes the records, but that written material was never put with the records. And so the records are kind of existing in their own little vacuum. Just the tape, and that's all you get. Electronic transfers have been done for many years, and there's a number of systems out there to use them. Of course, there's a number of people now who have done some very good transfers with the Archaeophone, for example, with folks at Santa Barbara have had great success with that. Glenn Sage at tinfoil.com has had great success with a long tone arm with a cartridge mounted on it that reproduces the cylinders. And for me, of course, I can't afford an Archaeophone unless I sell something, and my wife wouldn't like that. So in looking for a way to play this back, I had several criteria looked at. Of course, low impact on the records, so I wanted to have something that tracked lightly, which, quite frankly, finding something that tracks lighter than a Model C reproducer is not a big stretch. Something that would use many sizes of styluses. I didn't know at this time what the grooves looked like on these records, what kind of cutter was used on them. And of course, this is just one of many projects, so having something where you could change the styluses was important. Had to be allowed for mobile recording. The Historic Society they didn't like the idea of actually letting these records go. They wanted to keep them in-house. And in fact, when you end up working with Native American recordings, most groups do not want to let them go out of house anymore. And quite frankly, in my home studio, I didn't have the insurance to cover anything happening to them. So I had to be able to travel there. And then finally, had to have a flat recording equalization. As you know, most phono preamps do introduce the RIAA curve into it, which affects the bass and treble. Had to be able to get a flat recording off of them. So what I ended up using was the Edisonia, or ACT2 reproducer, marketed by Peter Liebert and Rob Lomas. I've been told I got one of the last ones before they stopped making those. It fits in a standard Edison iCarrier. It has a Stanton 500 cartridge in it. So once again, one of the archival or at least one of the more preferred styluses for reproducing any kind of material like this. Expert Stylus makes any number of different size stylus for this, so it worked perfectly. This is what mine looks like. It's one of the few white ones that are out there. It's a stereo output, and it's summed monophonically through a mixing board. And this is what it looks like in place. So for the purposes of this transfer, what I had was I had a recording board that I ran it, went to the preamp, to the recording board, and then into a DAT recorder. Now I realize that 9624 is the preferred archival method, but I honestly didn't have a mobile recorder at that time capable of doing that. So at least it was saved to a CD standard 44116, which worked. This is another view of it in place. I originally did the transfer with a standard phonograph and then moved to a home phonograph because with the more powerful spring motor on it, it gave a lot smoother reproduction on it. So here's a close-up, and I'm going to do a little comparison here. You're going to hear a little of that Indiana recording you heard before, just to kind of give you an idea, once again, of what it sounded like and what they've had to work with over the last few years. And this is the same record. This is the first record, which in the collection, this is the electronic transfer. That high sound you hear is an elk horn whistle. I mean, considering the period of time this was recorded in and the number of voices on it, that actually the transfer is very good. The cylinders were transferred in March and April of last year in two visits to the Historic Society. One was more for testing than anything else, and then the majority of the transfers were done the second time around. As I said before, they were transferred to the CD standard. At this time, I could actually, if I were to go back and revisit this, I could actually do it to archival standard. The equipment's become a lot more affordable since then. And then on the computer, it's transferred to, I used a SoundForge 8 to actually do the editing on it and to take the extraneous noise off of either end. There was no equalization done on these recordings. This particular quote here is very typical of a lot of the native listeners of this material. And I particularly like it. When I hear the cylinders, they lead to thoughts about what songs were still alive and what songs we had lost. They managed to survive this long and go back to the people. It was like a supernatural gift that had been given back to the people again. And it's interesting because as historians, we might listen to these recordings and you're hearing an event in time, something that happened more than 100 years ago, with a little snapshot, if you will, into the past. But to the Lakota who listen to this and the ones I've spoken with, these are their ancestors speaking directly to them. It's almost a supernatural thing. And actually, at the time that they recorded this, that was one of the things that George Sword mentioned, is the fact that through the phonograph, he was able to speak to his descendants directly. And so for them, it's more of a very direct contact. The records right now are in their present order. I didn't change the order on that until we can discover what's actually said on these. You heard at the very beginning of that recording, there's a little bit of announcement. And so the announcement at the very beginning, once that's actually translated, might give us some insight into seeing if the records are still in their original order. The literal translations I had them translated word for word by Loretta Afraid of Bear, who is Afraid of Bear's granddaughter. So there's actually a familial contact with this. Thomas Tyon, who was also called Gray Ghost, was one of Dr. Walker's confidants. And he actually described the Sundance and mentioned the record specifically. So at least we have that to go from and have some kind of description of what's there. The one broken record actually was in the Frink recording. So until we can come up with a better way to have the record repaired and to maybe do something with that, we actually do have a recording of the cylinder, just not in the best format. It's not identified in the Indiana recording. I'm not sure it's on there or not. But I just haven't located it. So there's more work to be done. And with a little bit of luck, the recording's been distributed among a number of Indian scholars, and hopefully they'll be able to give us a little more insight into what's on them. So I'm going to play you a couple of examples of the recordings and just give you a real feel for this. This is what the actual translation looks like in the literal translation. And what makes this one particularly interesting, basically, as this was described to me, this is this part of the Sundance. This is where they send the special children that are selected, the Ska Yuha, referred to some beloved children of the tribe who have done something good. And they are sent out to find the sacred tree that's going to be used for the Sundance. And they actually approach the tree, and then they have small sticks, and they strike the tree to awaken the tree and the spirit within the tree. Once again, you'll hear the very beginning of this, you hear the announcement of what the record is. It's probably George Sword's voice, we're not sure. This next cylinder here is one of my personal favorites, and this is actually this is sung by one of the chiefs. And once they've gathered the tree and they've brought it back to the camp and set out the ceremonial buffalo head that goes with it, this chief will sit, and when the sun is high in the sky, he will sing this song. And so it's very much just a very personal one person singing this, as opposed to everyone else singing. One thing you'll notice in these recordings is the last word, yellow. And that was described to me, that's very much, it's a punctuation within the language. And so they'll say something and da-da-da-da-da-da-da, yellow. It is so. It's basically saying that's the way it is. And they put that, it's pretty much on every recording, and you'll hear it in the spoken introduction.
Hey!
Finally, the last example I have for you is this one. And this one's, as it's described in the literature, is there's a number of songs that are performed at the end, or once the holy tree is in place, once everything's laid out, and this involves everybody in the tribe. This particular one, of course, has women in it, which makes it kind of interesting. You can sort of hear them, but this is more indicative of the entire tribe participating. And so that's it. As I say, it's my hope that that scholars will be able to look at this, maybe do some more translation on it, and put them more in the context of not only how the Sun Dance was possibly performed then, but also in the context of how it's being performed by their descendants now. I'm ready for questions, if anyone has any. Yes, ma'am. It's actually not in that bad a shape. It's in about 8 or 9 pieces. It was glued back together. It looks like with super glue.
Have you talked to Mike Angelian?
I have not. I've been told to do that. So
yes, he's magic. He's doing stuff with the Southwest Museum.
Yeah, because we can get it together, so at least it tracks. Yeah. It's easy enough with software to remove the pops out of it. Sure. So that's something I'm going to look into when I go back. Yes, sir.
I had two questions. I just don't know what size are the cylinders, and I don't quite understand. Is that the grooves are inside them?
Well, I was referring to the spiral groove that inside the record, and typically what I've seen with Columbia records, that groove is a lot more steep than it is in the Edison records.
And what size are they? How big are those cylinders?
These are standard size cylinders. In other words, so they're about that big. They're standard 2-minute records.
And then a content question. Do you have a sense of what this is a recording of? Do you think that you have a full ceremony, or do you think that you just have sort of snatches of things, or do you have no idea?
It's hard to tell. I think the recordings actually tried to at least provide a breadth of the ceremony. Of course, it's unlikely they were recorded at the ceremony. We don't know exactly where they're recorded, but it's pieces. And every Sundance ceremony is probably a little bit different. It's probably as close to getting the whole thing as you probably could. There could be elements missing, but at least from the text, it seems to indicate that the major elements where they seek out the tree, where they trim the branches from the tree, where they move the tree, where they present the buffalo head. All those things seem to be included in this collection. Yes? I'm sorry, I can't hear you.
Sorry, you said that there wasn't a lot of holes or anything on these. I was just curious, do you know from the time they were recorded, where they were
not sure how they were stored prior to being presented to the Society in 1958. Of course, in Colorado, it's dry, and so the mold doesn't tend to be as much of an issue at that point. Since then, they've been stored at the Society, which is more or less climate controlled. And in fact, since in the last 10 years, they've moved them from the original containers into archival containers. And nobody touches them. So the fact that they're in such wonderful shape was a surprise to me. I didn't know what I was going to find when I went into the collection. So I was very pleased to see what was there. Yes, sir. Well, obviously, on my budget, I'm not going to be able to have a laser tracking device to record them. At least the experiments they've done on them is, the one beautiful thing about a needle is that a needle discriminates. Generally, a stylus of any kind, whether you're talking about the original stylus that was designed or the modern electronic ones, is that they were designed to pick up the sound and try to reject as much of the other noise as possible. So in the case of the Edison records, they're designed to pick up that vertical indentation in the groove. The trouble with a laser system is the laser picks up everything. And so an effective laser system, at least from what I've read, has to have software that would do the job that the needle does naturally. And that's been an issue. That's a lot of computing power and a lot of storage space. I hope at some time we'll have that, and maybe we can get a little bit closer to getting a better reproduction off of these. Yes, sir?
Was determining the playback speed at all an issue with that, or is that just not really an issue with cylinder?
I had to guess.
Yeah.
And it's, just you work with records long enough, you kind of get an idea when a voice sounds too high. The original Freak recording you heard on there, they were a little bit fast. And even the Indiana ones are just a little bit fast to my ear. I mean, the beauty of these in the digital domain is if you had to adjust the speed, you could. So in one of the pictures I had in there, you notice I had the machine open. And I did that just because both my machines are Model B machines. And so you have to get inside to adjust the speed on it. And so I had to do it that way. Anyone else? Thank you very much.